This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lissina. Today, we talk to Nathan Contney. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me on here.
We're happy to have you. Nathan is the CEO of HiRise. He's a tech leader whose career has followed a somewhat unconventional path. He was trained as a nuclear chemist and discovered a talent for software programming when a broken ankle kept him chained to a desk so he wouldn't get his cast contaminated. He would go on to found not one or two, but three companies, including a Zynga for advertisers and the writing software he always wished he had. These experiences taught him many things, especially about the importance of tapping into your passion. Today, he'll talk about what he's learned and how writing fits in and how all that helps him run HiRise. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward three centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it. Hallelujah. It's called SignEasy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast. How are you, Nathan?
I'm good. Had a nice, refreshing 4 or 5 day weekend, so I'm good.
Awesome. Great. So you're all set for our chat.
That's right.
Very good. Well, let's start with one of your first real jobs as a nuclear chemist. Right? It's not a bad way to sort of start out your professional life. Can we talk a little bit about what you did there? Just because I think people would like to hear what that job was like.
sure, yeah. It was, that was my kind of first foray into the, professional world in college. It was an internship I had between my junior and senior years, and that was the thing that was really going to, give me the experience of like what it was really like to be a chemical engineer. And yeah, it was at a uranium processing plant, which is, we basically worked with uranium ore in the kind of the first process before getting it ready to become radioactive. And so natural uranium isn't this radioactive stuff out of the box. You kind of have to concentrate it. And so we were this crazy process where you had to hit the uranium with something called hydrofluoric acid, which is the worst acid on the planet. You hit those two things together, and then it turns into this other compound that you ship off to people to do another thing with. We were around some really crazy chemicals. And it kind of probably fits into your imagination of what maybe a place like that would be. It's kind of scary. It's really, there's a lot of safety hazards. Mm-hmm. I'd go in and out the door with going through a Geiger counter to make sure you weren't tracking uranium outside or maybe stealing it, possibly too. You were wearing, you had to keep a gas mask on you at all times, sometimes multiple gas masks, depending on, if you were going into other parts of the plant that had different kind of, deadly gases. And it was crazy. Yeah. I remember even one experiment I had to do. It was dealing with near the hydrofluoric acid, and I had to wear an acid-proof suit. It was like this crazy suit. You probably, if you've watched Breaking Bad, it's the kind of stuff they would wear, those yellow suits.
Yeah.
And I'd have to wear the suit, and it's like 105 degrees out in the summertime in Kentucky, and you're instantly soaking wet as soon as you step outside the door with this suit on. And it was like that, you know, often, a lot of days, and it was just, it was a tough environment to work in. I applaud the people who do it, but I didn't have the passion for it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and so you break your ankle, right? And everything that you'd worked for kind of gets put on pause, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you come in there to prepare for to get a sort of a sneak peek into a new life as a particular, very specific profession, and then you get kind of sidelined to this desk. Like initially, like what were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the future I had envisioned was probably at plants like this. I mean, and even going through, you know, the effort there and even realizing, like, I hope I'm not in a plant like this when I graduate, it still was on the table. I mean, I was probably still going to be applying to oil refineries and other chemical plants. But, yeah, so I luckily and in many ways broke my ankle that summer playing basketball. You know, I had this cast on, and immediately when I went back to work, they were like, we can't have you walking around the plant with this cast, because if it gets contaminated with uranium, which is very possible, we're going to have to break the cast off. You can't walk around in the outside world with uranium in your cast. So they stuck me in a trailer, like, away from the rest of the plant, and you know, basically so I couldn't interact with other, you know, the people in the plant and do the experiments that I was doing. And they just gave me a computer and basically started feeding me programming tasks that I could do. I mean, they didn't want to waste the rest of my internship and send me home. So they just gave me things to program, like Excel macros my boss needed to help manage the plant or do some financial forecasts. And so I basically sat there doing computer programming, even in a little tiny stage of just Excel macros. But just even that little bit with the computer, I just realized I loved it so much more than the chemical engineering I was doing. I loved the problem solving I was doing. I loved the more of the safe nature of programming this thing. And I also liked the control that I had on it. A lot of chemical processes, especially the stuff I was even doing in the plant, I was dealing with chemistry that even after decades of study, people didn't fully understand. And so there were so many problems that we were trying to make efficient, but you know, the nature of chemistry and especially, you know, volatile chemistry like this, hazardous chemistry, there's things that are happening in these reactors that not everybody can even fully explain.
Yeah.
But computers aren't usually like that. I mean, when I make an Excel macro, like I know every line of code, what it does. And there's something very attractive to me about that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And so you're still very young. You're at the very beginning of your career. You haven't graduated yet, and you realize I've studied for the wrong career.
Yeah. It wasn't a pleasant thought process.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, did I just waste all this time, you know, and money and a lot of effort? I mean, getting a chemical engineering degree isn't an easy task. And so it definitely was like, okay, well, I better get started changing things up now. And so, yeah, when I started looking for jobs, I immediately tried to find then what might be a job that would maybe get me closer to doing a lot more computer software development, even though that's not my background, that's not my training. So I lucked into this a little bit. I mean, I sought out Accenture. They used to be called Anderson Consulting at the time.
Yeah.
But they did, you know, all this IT consulting. And I know a lot of people are kind of telling me, like, don't do it. You're going to be doing all this data entry, and it's not a very good place to work. But I was like, but it's closer to the realm of software and the business world, which is what I feel like I need to retrain myself and do. And I got some other job offers from some oil refineries and some other places. And so, but I jumped at this ability, this opportunity at Accenture. And it wasn't even for a job that was actually in software development. They actually put me in a job doing something called process, which is at the time, you know, when you're an entry level person, it was very much just kind of like project management,
sure,
but very secretarial. Like I would constantly just take meeting notes, mm-hmm, make sure people were signing all the right documents and reading all the requirements. And it was very much just paperwork, but it was a step in the door. It was a foot in the door to this world that I wanted to enter into. And I took full advantage of that. training myself. I would stay at work every day, working on their computers, training, like learning Java and learning to program and reaching out to engineers that were at Accenture, you know, asking them how to solve problems and, you know, taking any online courses Accenture had, using their internet. It was, you know, the internet at home is so slow.
Yeah.
I use Accenture's internet to download the, what was like 7 DVDs or CDs of, to download Java at the time. And so that foot in the door led me to basically retraining myself as a software engineer. Eventually I convinced some people at Accenture to give me a new job and to transfer me into their engineering groups and let me do software development. I was showing, you know, some aptitude there on my own, and they gave me a different job. And that's just kind of where my software career took off.
Sure. And so you continue in with development. Eventually you get into Y Combinator, right? Not just once, but twice, right? Is my research correct? By the second time, in 2011, you end up working on sort of a buzzy sort of project that I'm sure that anybody listening to this would be like, oh yeah, that would make total sense. The Zynga for advertisers, right? Can you talk a little bit about that project and what it was?
Yeah, so I did Y Combinator the first group out of Silicon Valley. So it was the winter of 2006.
Yeah.
And then I did it again in 2011. We had kind of, you know, the first company we had started, you know, was definitely kind of in a very, you know, kind of at its peak. And we had employees that could do it. So my partner and I were interested in like what the next thing could be. And we saw things like Groupon success in the advertising and marketing world. And then we saw the success Zynga was having with games. And so our minds went to this place where we were like, well, you know what, we could maybe marry these things. Like, what would Groupon 2.0 look like? Like, what would be the thing that we could create that would be a platform for a lot of people who would want to advertise and market their products on, and we could take advantage of the hot place that games are right now? So we created, basically, yeah, like you said, Zynga for advertisers. We created a suite of games using very popular game mechanics. We had games like Bejeweled, where you match up the jewels and you get 4 in a row and you get they disappear and you get a score. But instead of jewels, we replaced the jewels with images that we would take from an advertiser, from a client of ours. So, you know, we did business with ABC, and they had a bunch of new TV shows at the time, and they gave us pictures of, you know, the logos for the show and some of the actors and actresses, and we put those in the games. And so people would play these games, and they would see, you know, logos for ABC and the new show that was coming out this fall. And so we created this suite of games, and we tried to go, find a lot of people who wanted to pay us to put their pictures and things in our kind of suite of games.
Yeah. And then what happened?
Well, I mean, we felt like we were seeing some early success from users playing the games. We had people playing like on average 2 hours a day, which was Zynga-like numbers.
Sure.
People were kind of addicted to playing our versions of this, and they were trying to win prizes that ABC was giving away, I forget, like posters and t-shirts and whatever, and people were trying to win this stuff. But the real sort of challenges started coming in when we tried to sell it. We did some deals early on with people who were close to us, you know, companies we knew and had some close relationships with that were willing to experiment. But then to make any real money, we need to start reaching out to people who would, you know, do some bigger deals. And I remember like reaching out to Procter & Gamble. I think we had a decent amicable conversation with. But it was insane trying to convince them that this was of any value to them. You know, there was a lot of questions about what's the ROI. And I think they were hoping like, well, if we do this, will people start, you know, buying our product from your site and from the, you know, store? And it's like, well, no, it's very unlikely these people who are going to be playing with your images are going to click something to go buy diapers right now.
Sure.
But maybe if they're going to Walgreens later, they'll think of Pampers versus Huggies or something.
Yeah.
But it's a very difficult conversation, and so the sales process was taking forever, and we had no conviction to see it through. We had no passion about this product. We didn't play these games. Like, I wasn't a Bejeweled player. I just knew that it was a hot game, but I wasn't playing this stuff. And I also wasn't like Procter & Gamble. I didn't have a big need for brand advertising where I need people to remember, you know, one of my, you know, brand labels out in a store. And so we were basically, yeah, creating products, this product for people who we didn't understand, but we also didn't really have a very, like, passion to see it through. So when we realized that these conversations with brands were going to take months, probably 9 months to close a deal, we just didn't have it in us to keep going.
Yeah.
And then when we met with VCs, there was, again, a difficult conversation because I think they saw the same kind of difficulty with selling this product. We couldn't get any investment dollars. And so, again, it was like, well, do we bootstrap it? And it was like, well, we bootstrapped before, and that took a lot of passion and a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think I've got it in me to see this type of business to, you know, bootstrap it over the years to see some success out of it. So we had to shut it down. We had to give up.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point, because I think a lot of times when people talk about, like, you know, failure and stuff, it's about something that, you know, maybe isn't working, where the actual, maybe something's core wrong with the business or where the customer is or something like that. But with this one, I think what's interesting is that possibly it would have been like something that could have had a future if you guys really sort of wanted to continue with it. And I think what's interesting about that is that so often, you know, that is a reality of startups, where the certain types of things are going to be more likely to get funded, and the path is going to be paved for certain types of businesses that just happen to be hot at the moment. They happen to be part of the conversation, but you have to be in it still, right? That passion element still has to be there, or it all falls apart. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean. And you can even see, like, so many of these elements, you know, were pretty valid, I think. I mean, I think we had some valid insight. Like, even today, what is it, like, quiz show that's taking off like crazy? And,
yeah.
You know, all these people are playing this game to win some prizes. And so I feel like we had the demand side of people who wanted to play these games. We understood how to get them in a little bit. And then, you know, like, you could argue, I mean, people have been exploring things like product placement in games for a while. There's something there. I mean, yeah, I think someone could still pull this company off, but I think they really need to be much closer to the problem. Like, Procter & Gamble should probably, you know, start this business. This should be something that they invest in and get close to, because they'd understand it very well and maybe have the passion to see it to fruition. But yeah, we couldn't. We didn't have anything behind us to want to see the struggle to turn this into a real business.
Yeah, it's sort of the devil, the danger of buzz, right? You know, like, it's like we all see the possibility, but you still have to take it to the end zone, you know. And so you take some time off. You take some time off, and what do you start doing after your Zynga for Advertisers?
I was. After that, it was like, well, what is the next thing? And I was kind of flailing around, didn't really know what to do. I had some money saved up still to take another shot at something, but I didn't know what it was. You know, I ended up taking a break. I mean, to the ire of some, I'm sure some people listening to this, but I worked on the engineering team for the Obama campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
But a friend of mine was the CTO there, and I really wanted to just get my head out of startups for a while.
Yeah.
I'm not a very big, you know, political, you know, fan. I'm not the one who's really, you know, in Twitter feverishly on anybody's side. But it was like, it was a way for me to escape some of the challenges of running a business. And I basically got to work on a really, you know, interesting team of people, very smart people, and just basically take orders for a while, you know,
like, yeah.
Oh, sure, I'll make that go faster. Yep, I'll build that. And it was a nice little break, you know, cleared my head a little bit. And then I knew it was only going to be temporary. So when the re-election was done, I mean, we were all fired and had to find our next thing. That was fine. You know, it was like, okay, I'm done. Now what am I going to do? And I then was able to kind of approach it from a fresh mindset. You know, through that time, I kept writing.
Mm-hmm.
I realized one of the other mistakes I made when running the Zynga for Games was I wasn't still doing any audience building.
Mm-hmm.
So I also knew whatever my next project was, I was still going to be launching it into just a like a tiny audience that I had on, say, Twitter. You know, we had built up this big audience of people playing our games, but none of them knew me. We weren't like these, you know, they weren't following what we were doing because they wanted to know who Nathan was. They were, or the stories I was telling, or the teachings I was providing. It was all about, you know, winning a prize or whatever. And so I really worried about that. Like when the campaign is over, what am I going to do? I'm still going to have no audience. So I spent a lot of time, even before I had another product idea, building an audience.
Yeah.
Worrying about like, well, let me start writing a lot, at least one article a week. I'll publish to a blog and see how it goes. And I got some traction. Mm-hmm. It started taking off. I was, you know, hitting some sites like Y Combinator News, yep, a bunch. And I really made sure to get people to kind of follow me on Twitter, mm-hmm, sign up to a newsletter. So I got to keep a little bit more of this audience around me that might've been ephemeral, but now they're ready maybe to hear about my next project. And so, yeah, when the campaign was over, I was finally ready, I thought, to tackle on another project. From all this writing, I had some ideas of how I could improve writing. And so, yeah, that's when I did Draft.
Yeah, and tell people what Draft is.
So Draft is just some online writing software. It's got a very different take from, you know, just kind of signing up for, say, Google Docs or Microsoft Word. One, I wanted to make it all online, but it's very different just even than the feeling of say Google Docs, where say Google Docs tries to replicate the experience of Microsoft Word in many ways, which is fine. There's a lot of people who need that. But Draft was my attempt at being very opinionated about just a few specific things that say a blogger needs, or, you know, someone who's writing articles needs, someone who looked a lot like me at the time and still today. And giving me just some specific utilities to become a better writer. Mm-hmm. I didn't need Google Docs. I didn't need Microsoft Word. I needed some things that I wasn't finding in those tools. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I put in a draft, a few things that I didn't see in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of the features of Draft that help, you know, someone become a better writer?
So a big part was just even version control. I mean, it was like there were so many places where, you know, using Microsoft Word felt heavy. And Google Docs felt heavy, and those things have like auto save. But then say you wanted to write a blog post, and most of the blog post platforms at the time, I think even WordPress at the time, didn't have auto save.
Yeah.
You would go to these text boxes and you would write something, and God forbid your browser crashes or your computer crashes or something happens, you lose everything. So it was like, this has to stop. Like, people don't need a very sophisticated tool like a Microsoft Word, but they need something stripped down to write in that's at least going to save the versions of what they're doing. So really early on, I just focused on really good autosave and some version control. So you could kind of mark your major versions of your work. I kept finding, you know, I would write something and then I would basically like save it off into Evernote. I would like save a copy off there because I knew I wanted to take like a really different stab at it. So I'd mess with it, but I didn't want to lose that major version that I had created so I could look back at it. I didn't want to, you know, when you're using things like Google Docs, Microsoft Word, it's saving all the like tiny changes without really these indications of the major changes. And so I built that right into the product, a way to kind of, you know, denote this is a major different document than the previous one. Stuff like that. So just simple version control, also kind of the ability to track changes that Microsoft Word was doing okay, but no one else was. You know, when I collaborate as a writer on a blog post or an article, you don't do that collaboratively at the same time. And it's funny, all these people talk about real-time editing and they give you these tools where 2, 3, 4, 10 people could all be on the same document typing away. And, you know, you probably know this working an entrepreneur, but most writers we don't need 10 people on the document at the same time. That's not how we write.
Yeah.
You know, you might send it to an editor for feedback and they're going to give you feedback and they might change some things, but you don't send it to a group of 10 people all speaking at one time in the document. That's a very different problem that, you know, Google Docs addresses. So my version was just, yeah, you can send it to one to many people, but then when they send you changes, you get to see their individual changes and accept them or reject them.
Yeah.
So still the document is yours. No one's overwriting it. They're just suggesting changes. It was very different at the time. And so, yeah, those things were very, very resonated, I think, with a lot of people writing blog posts and writing articles.
Yeah. Why was this so important to you to make this software?
Well, I mean, it was this is where, I mean, it was so much different from advertising for games or Zynga for advertising. It was like writing was everything to me. I mean, it was like something that you know, whether or not I can even like articulate it, I felt passion about. I mean, I love storytelling. I love engaging people with my words. I love inspiring people. I love teaching people. So all these things kind of were in it, but it was just finally this thing where it's just like, well, now I'm getting traction building this audience. And it was, you know, now I'm building a bunch of people who are interested in the stuff that I was doing. I was launching Draft and, you know, a bunch of people were now beta testing it just because I simply tweeted about it. I simply wrote about it on my blog. And it was like, wow, this is so much cooler. I'm working on something I have all this passion about. I see so clearly the features that are needed and what people need versus, you know, with advertising for games, like I'm going into these conversations with Procter & Gamble and I don't know what they need. You know, it's pulling teeth, like asking them, like, please tell us what you need and I'll build it for you.
Yeah.
But this is like, I don't even need all that much feedback. Like I'm making it. And because I write, I'm probably, you know, there's probably a lot of other writers who are like me and it so happens there were.
Yeah.
But it was a combination of all those things, but definitely getting much working on something that was so much closer to a problem that I cared about. You know, I live and breathe, you know, reading and writing. It's just this thing that I love to do and was finally now able to make a product to support it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's interesting. And through that, it's sort of as a culmination of all your experiences, right? So you've got an audience now that you can, as you mentioned, now that you can put this out to, get a little bit of traction, help get beta testing, help get a little bit of visibility. But you also have the learnings from the other businesses, and you aren't so precious with, with launching. You know, you're a little bit able to sort of not overcomplicate things and just sort of move quickly, right? I mean, there's this sort of moment where you're like, okay, I've learned all these things and I can kind of put them all into motion with this like passion project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really interesting. And so how does all of that prepare you for HiRISE, for running a CRM tool, right? How do you employ all that in your current role?
Yeah, it's so multifaceted. It's like, yeah, this is so many tangents can come out of this, but it's like a big thing that happened with that people need to maybe understand about the HiRISE thing was all of that really did lead to HiRISE. Like it was, you know, because I was working on Draft,
sure,
and building this audience, I started just building. I mean, the audience just started building and building and building. I caught the awareness, and part of this was also just my doing. I had reached out to Jason Fried at Basecamp. They may have been 37 Signals still at the time. And I reached out to him and I said that I'm working on this writing software. And, you know, I know you're a big writer and you're a big proponent of getting better at writing. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help people kind of use the software to kind of get their writing better. And would you come on in as an advisor? And sure, like we would meet every now and then talking about the product. And so just, I caught his attention, and so when they did this whole change from 37 Signals to Basecamp, and they wanted to do something with HiRISE, I was, you know, really high on his radar of someone who could take this over.
Yeah.
And so that was one thing, just the audience building, and my knack for trying to encourage more and more people to kind of see what I'm doing led to the opportunity of HiRISE.
Yeah.
The reason I jumped on it so fast was, again, it was like this being close to the problem. HiRISE is something that I've been using since it launched back in 2007 to help build all these businesses I've created. I mean, it was the thing that we were using, my partner and I, to organize, you know, contacts and talking to leads and, you know, trying to follow up with people and trying to, you know, use for customer support. And so I had so many things that I wanted out of the product because I was trying to use it to fulfill all of these problems and things that I needed myself. So again, it fit into this, like, I really know this product well. I know its deficiencies. I know what, you know, the future, like, could look for it, you know, fulfilling these things that I needed from it. And so it was, again, like this feels like something I could have a lot of passion for, because it's a problem that I've been very close to, and it would be something I would use every day, just like I use Draft every single day still to this day. I want to make HiRISE the thing that I'm going to use every single day to support my business, and we succeeded at that. So that was a big draw to leaping at that role.
Sure, sure, sure. How do you think, I think it's interesting you were talking about, Jason at Basecamp and also yourself, the interest in writing and that sort of connection. And how do you think that maybe writing gives you maybe a different perspective? It makes you a different type of leader. What impact does that have?
Yeah, I think, again, this is probably, I'm going to miss like various aspects of this, but I think some stuff that stands out is, spending so much time just with words in text on a page outside of someone speaking them or you watching them, I think lets you kind of attune to the emotion more of mm-hmm. words sometimes, and the subtlety and the nuance of like what they're trying to convey and what maybe was behind those words and the context and the emotions. And so I feel like that's helped me quite a bit become a more efficient leader, especially for a remote company like ourselves. So HiRISE is all remote. There's seven of us. Everyone's somewhere else, except for two of us in Chicago. And so we spend all day just in a chat room. Yeah. And very rarely we get on, a video chat. But most of our problems and most of our planning and strategy and everything else is all planned in just various chat rooms. And it makes us really efficient. I feel like a little less, since there's only seven of us, it's still a little less interruptive than a lot of team meetings and scheduled meetings. We can do things still more asynchronously. Someone can drop a message and not have to get to it for a while. We don't have to be everybody stop what they're doing. Let's get in a phone call. And so I think we're able to do that and do it efficiently, because I feel like I can pick out some of the nuance in some of what we're saying better now because of the time I spent with writing. I mean, I had an example just this week or just last week where I felt like the conversation was getting, we were all conversing about the design of a certain product feature. We were doing some planning too of some short-term things that we could launch. And everybody was in the room, we were all getting feedback, but then it started to become a little counterproductive. I thought the conversation was, I felt maybe a little heat coming from mm-hmm. some of the people in the conversation. And it's one of those things that I don't know if a lot of people can read that type of emotion as well in text. Mm-hmm. You need to be on a phone, you need to be face to face, but I've gotten much better, I think, at reading some of this. And so I was able to kind of get the conversation cooled down a little bit. I separated someone into a private chat so that we could kind of talk without mm-hmm. the heat of the rest of the group. This type of management, I don't think is very natural when you start off doing it, but it's something I think I've learned now, just getting better with the written word. Mm-hmm. And it's made us just a more efficient organization. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's one thing.
Yeah, yeah. And in that, there's a certain close reading that you're doing when you're looking at those chats. What are you looking for to sort of know, okay, I need to maybe isolate this person and chat with them and give them some private time? What are you looking for when you do that close reading?
Yeah, I mean, again, this feels hard to articulate just because it's come from a lot of practice.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to be like, well, these are the red light words I'm looking for.
Sure.
But it's like, as you do this and as you practice your own craft of writing, I mean, you start to, I think, feel like you get a feel for, when these words go together, I mean, this is a potent thing to say, or this sounds like someone who's aggravated, or this mm-hmm. sounds like someone who isn't just kind of logically explaining anything, but now they're maybe taking an argument personally. Mm-hmm. It might be hard to articulate, but it's like with practice, we've gotten there, and we, doing it enough, you start to feel it. And so we actually, when we interview people, we do this where we get people in a chat room, and it's one of our first steps in the interview process. Like after you've emailed us, like we do most of our we interview people, we ask them a series of questions over email, and we look at their responses, because if they can't convey it over email, again, this is a red light that they're not going to work well here at HiRISE, because so much of our work is just in text. So it's like if you can't get your answers, well across this email, like you're going to probably not pass phase one. Phase two is we do a lot of just online chats with people, getting in this Skype or our chat room or whatever. And again, we're looking for people who are comfortable with, say, you know, articulating an argument to something. My CTO, Michael Dwan, he's got this, he purposefully gets a little bit, you know, he plays devil's advocate with mm-hmm. people a little bit in these chat rooms. He tries to coax them into a bit of an argument, mm-hmm. you know, to defend themselves about something. And what he's looking for is, can this person defend an argument that they have in text, in a chat? Because if they have difficulty with this, they're going to have a difficult employment here at Highrise probably. Mm-hmm. Because over and over again, they're going to find themselves needing to defend a position they have, whether it's design or infrastructure or a programming challenge. And he wants to know that they don't fall apart in that space. And of course, this isn't for everybody, but this is the environment we have. And so we kind of hire for that environment. You know, if we were a company with a very, you know, locally based headquarters, we would probably do it differently. Let's get everybody in the room and make sure we all communicate very good, you know, offline, but we're online. So, you know, we really look for people who are comfortable kind of in debate, arguing, you know, taking direction, all from just a group chat.
Sure, sure. Well, I think what's interesting about that, too, is that, you know, part of what you're testing there also is, do you have an idea? You know, so many times people are sort of maybe willing to sort of go to the default position and let, you know, someone else sort of lead the way. But in a small team, everyone really needs to be bringing ideas to the table. And if you can't communicate your idea and later on you kind of go to your spouse, you say, well, nobody listens to me, but you didn't say anything. That's not so helpful, especially in a small team when everybody's voice is so important. But I think that what you said earlier too about, you know, the context, right? I think people forget about how as sort of little animals roaming the universe here, context is everything for us, and how we're able to sort of navigate and read our environment is really, really important, and the cues that we give to other people are constant. And so we have to be able to read cues and sort of read the world as a novel in a lot of ways. I mean, if you kind of look at it that way, so it's like, well, if someone's reacting in a certain way, like I can tell that they're annoyed, I can tell that they're closing up. You know, what are they doing? You know, why are they feeling that way? You know, being able to sort of read other people. I mean, I think that's a really interesting tool for leaders, but also for anybody who has to work with other staff on a chat situation, frankly.
Right. And I think a lot of people avoid it. I mean, you keep seeing these examples of people, you know, when it gets into a heated situation. I mean, there's a pro and con to this. Like, I mean, we do still, you know, I notice if a conversation is getting a little heated, we might still end up having to go to video,
sure,
or phone,
of course,
or whatever. I mean, that's definitely, I don't want to get into some battle because people don't understand each other.
Sure.
And it become you know, we can't recover from this argument. But I also see people too quickly go to, you know, like, let's not chat. Let's get this off the email. Like, let's just go to phone. And then they never get better at this.
Sure.
You know, they never, and our world is just, you know, progressively becoming more and more online text. And it's like, well, it's time as leaders, we've got to own this and get better in chat rooms and email. We can't just keep sending, like, one-line emails that maybe don't provide enough context and just assume everybody's going to get in a meeting where we all have to stop everything that we're doing to plan a meeting. I think we need to kind of own it a little bit more than most people are.
No, I think it's interesting, and I think that I always feel like as a history and English major that I've been given this incredible advantage that I don't think I ever really appreciated at the time. But understanding context in writing and in words is something that you know, if you haven't, you know, had to sort of think about it, it may not be natural. And so it is easy to sort of have some sort of a mysterious, we've all had those mysterious emails, the mysterious one-line text,
yep,
where it's like,
yep,
I don't know what's happening. Are you a spy? Like, what is happening? Like, what do I do with this information? But it's,
yep,
quite natural. And so, again, it's put on the person who's a recipient to sort of unpack it, and what are their motivations? How do I pull this information out of them? Of course, you know, but it's just the sort of thing that can sort of create misunderstanding or, at the worst part, you know, discord, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. And you brought up another really great topic about, how we, interview and see people, they have to come up with their own ideas. And there's something interesting about being in a chat room and doing this with text all day. It's somehow it's easier to quantify because you can see it visually who's talking. Like when you're in a room and you have a meeting, a live meet space human space meeting, I think it gets away from people. And, the manager or the boss finds themselves doing most of the talking. And you might not even realize that you're hogging the entire bandwidth of the conversation. But it becomes much more clear when you're in a chat room and it's just your avatar who's got all the words on the screen. There's something that really stands out that's like, whoa, you've done all the talking. No one else is saying anything. That's probably very bad. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, being another leadership thing, someone was asking me the other day, like, how do I, get the best ideas in the room? And it's really like, well, it's just shutting up a lot.
Yeah.
I'm in these chat rooms and I know people are having an argument and they're discussing something. And I think a lot of people's bosses and managers, their knee-jerk reaction is to get in there mm-hmm. and say something, cool it down, give their opinion, stop the argument. And it's like, I tend to try to not say anything. I try to do my best to let them work it out. Even if I do have an opinion, I can share my opinion tomorrow or next week. Let them figure out what their best idea is here. And make their voices heard. Because as soon as the boss is in there doing something, it shuts everybody up and you don't want that.
Sure, sure. And I think what's interesting about that, and I think what's maybe helpful, in these situations is that it's uncomfortable. And so you want to help, right? That's natural for anyone to sort of want to step in. But the most important thing you can do is to just lean back, right?
Right.
And let somebody have that moment of discomfort because it will pass and they will get stronger. That's really interesting. Well, Nathan, that is unfortunately all the time that we have for today. But
this has been,
I know, just as it was getting good. But I don't want to steal your entire day, sir. But anyway, I think that this has been awesome. And these insights have been a real treat for people. And before we go, some short announcements for our listeners. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And don't be afraid to give us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. And for more stories like this one on the mindset that you need to start and grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.